Hello, welcome to the special brunch edition of Bombshell. I'm Lauren Shulman.
I'm Radha Iyengar.
And I'm Erin Simpson.
And this week we are drinking champagne, but quite fancy champagne.
Well, I don't know if it's fancy, but it's Schramsberg Blanc de Blancs.
It sounds fancy.
It's quite delicious. Well, you can't drink bourbon for brunch. I mean, you can, but even I don't drink bourbon for brunch. But we have an assortment of goodies. My little brother made us coffee cake because he's the best.
So. It's quite delicious.
We have fruit. We have some really fancy cheese.
Really fancy. I highly recommend the cheese market at Eastern Market if you want delicious cheeses.
And we're a bit upmarket this week because we have a special guest coming on later, Kelly Maximin, the former Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Asia Pacific Affairs.
Which is a mouthful.
PDASDI, APSA, and probably like seven other acronyms that I'm forgetting, who is both brilliant and delightful. So we're excited to have her here this week. First, we want to get into the questions that we had coming in from the audience that we posted on Warhol.
So Warhol is a subscription-only service for the most dedicated and incisive national security professionals, brought to us from our friends at War on the Rocks. And so if you want to let us know what we're getting right and what we're getting wrong, and it's just a sort of more community-driven place than Twitter, which can be kind of a crazy town sometimes.
It's a snark fest. But the purpose of these questions is less for us to, you know, wow you with our amazing prowess on lots of topics, and more for what are the bizarre national security issues that you've been curious about for a long time that you may have even discussed in public before and have absolutely no idea what they mean, whether it be acronyms or strange habits at the Pentagon, or why on earth do we have a Marine Corps, which I think is our first question this weekend.
We got one of our questions from Twitter, actually. Was what's the deal with the Marines? Where do they fit in the ground forces as compared with the Army or Special Operations Forces? This is a great question because, of course, the Marines struggle with whether or not they are part of the ground forces. They, of course, are part of the Department of the Navy. Just by way of sort of numbers, the Marine Corps is substantially smaller than the Army. They've got about 180,000 active duty members as compared to 470,000 in the active duty Army. The Army, of course, has a much larger reserve and guard component. Yada, 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 as well. And Special Operations Forces are, of course, an order of magnitude smaller.
And span all of the services.
Yes, span all the services, exactly. The Marines also, I would say, are there's an apocryphal Navy attaché or military attaché, a joke that's told about he understands why your Navy has an Army, but why does your Navy's Army also have an Air Force? The Marines, of course, have both ground and air components. And the short answer to that is Guadalcanal. And I'll let, in the Warhol, you can chime in and hear more about all of that. But the probably the one major place that in terms of, I don't know, mission sets that the Marines focus on is contingency response. They do a lot of embassy evacuations, not because there are Marines guarding embassies, but because there are Marines floating around on ships and waiting around the world for various things to happen. So, for example, the Marines who are in Syria were aboard the 11th MEU, that's the Marine Expeditionary Unit, and after following exercises in Oman and Djibouti, they've now been assigned, at least a portion of them have been assigned, to operations in Syria. So that's one example of kind of the kinds of things the Marine Corps ends up doing.
And they do disaster response and humanitarian assistance.
For sure.
A similar model.
They're kind of pre-positioned, or they're in the neighborhood, as it were, and they're in the neighborhood by design. One of the things that was controversial around the whole Benghazi discussion was that there was not a MEU in the Mediterranean at the time. The MEUs had been reduced from 3 to 2 at some point and were assigned elsewhere. But that is, broadly speaking, where the Marines fit as compared to the rest of the ground forces, whether they are or not a ground force, left for as an exercise for the reader or the listener. Okay, our next question comes from the Warhol, a little more fun. What bar would you recommend for a person who is a retired NCO or who is otherwise not interested in the college crowd and is looking for a good bourbon collection to choose from? This is a subject near and dear to all of our hearts.
I'll start out the bidding here, which is, I think the Boundary Stone, which is, I guess, technically in Bloomingdale, but in the Shaw area, it's excellent. In fact, many years ago, a friend of mine who lived in the area thought that we ought to organize just taste an entire row of their bourbon. And we worried for our livers and our long-term health, so we never did it. But they have a really quite astounding bourbon collection, also pretty delicious wings, and I highly recommend it as a bar.
Excellent. Lauren, do you have bourbon bar suggestions?
I think this is less a bourbon bar and more just a wonderful bar that is not the kind of college crowd. Room 11 in Columbia Heights is just a fabulous tiny little bar, very cozy, has amazing bartenders that if you say, like, here's generally what I'm looking for, they have tasted everything on the face of the earth and will create a magical drink for you, and is near a lot of amazing restaurants as well.
And then, of course, we have the better-known bourbon establishments of town. Jack Rose, of course, I think is still king of that particular hill. It's starting to warm up a little, which means you can get bourbon snow cones upstairs, which is exactly what it sounds. It's a paper cup of crushed ice with bourbon poured on it. It's delicious. Southern Efficiency, also in Shaw, and sort of part of the broader, there's a row of bars and restaurants all owned by the same folks there, has a lovely bourbon and whiskey collection. I myself am partial to Barrel, which is your Capitol Hill joint, and they have...
We'll certainly get the job done.
And they have interesting craft cocktails, and just a really, they have a lot of Japanese whiskeys.
They do.
Which
and they
is
have
nice.
Barrel-aged whiskey cocktails, which are quite delicious if you're looking for to mix your whiskey with other alcohols and
exactly.
then age it in a barrel.
Exactly. So that's a range of options for the non-college bourbon enthusiast.
So we are incredibly excited to have a special guest this week. Kelly Maximin is the former Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Asia-Pacific Security Affairs. That's a really long title. Amongst other amazing things she did in government, senior director for strategic planning, worked on Iran and the National Security Council. She may have taken over small countries. I'm not sure. We are so excited to have you here at Bombshell this week. Welcome.
It's great to be here.
So first, as we do with all of our guests, we're going to go through our Bombshell guest questions. The most important of which, what is the best meal you have ever eaten while traveling?
Okay, so I'm totally torn on this. First would be the hawker stalls in Singapore, which have absolutely the best
amazing
food. Singapore just in general has great food because it's such a mash of cultures between Indians and Malaysians and Chinese. So I would definitely say the hawker stalls. Second runner up, though, would be a hot dog spam ramen dish that I ate in Korea.
I might throw up
which
right now.
It sounds
that sounds disgusting.
Absolutely horrible. And of course, when they first told me we were going to have this meal, I was like, you know, I don't really do spam heavy. even though I've been, you know, raised in North Carolina and spent a lot of time in Hawaii, I still don't like spam very much. But it was one of the best things I've ever eaten. And it was so good for that cold, cold Korean winter.
I will wait for my next hangover and see if I can
total
probably,
hangover food.
Yeah, absolutely. So this question isn't really fair because you've been on so many. What is your best geek field trip that you've ever been on?
Well, ironically, SCIE staff rides.
Oh my God. I just saw Elliot Cohen post about one the other day.
They're in Scotland or something.
They were
right
in Scotland doing the, what was it? The Jacobite Rebellion of 1475. My favorite was, my favorite was Waterloo.
Wow.
It was horribly cold and miserable. And I thought of it yesterday when the healthcare debacle happened.
Okay, the last question. I can't believe I have to ask this question, but I will for Aaron and for Radha. What is your favorite statistical distribution?
I did research for this one.
Okay.
Okay, so it is a discrete probability distribution called Poisson.
That is mine, and that is amazing.
That's fantastic!
It's French, which is why I picked it.
Do you know what it is?
Like so I do. I wrote down the definition. It's a probability of a given number of events occurring in a fixed interval of time.
That's like, right. It's a count model. It's beautiful.
Like,
it's
like
so beautiful.
Trump tweets.
Like I'm you can predict. You can totally use a Poisson model for predicting Trump
exactly.
tweets.
Exactly.
I don't think they have mean variance equivalents, but I think you could surely start there. That'd be, oh, that's good.
I am so sorry to everybody.
Very excited.
Who's a person like me.
About Poisson modeling Trump tweets.
I mean, I had to Google it.
It's fine. Research. It's important.
Research.
Not everybody is an expert in everything, so you've got to dig in on occasion.
That's right. Use the Googles.
So, Secretary Tillerson just concluded a big Asia trip, his first in the administration, came after a fairly positively received Mattis trip earlier this year. Tillerson's reviews were maybe
mixed.
Not so hot, I would say. Maybe that's a generous term, but I'm curious about somebody who is an actual Asia expert. walk us through his trip, because he apparently had some ups and some downs, some fatigued moments, and some inappropriate comments.
Okay. Well, let's sort of set the stage in Asia just generally before he went to the trip. So I would say you've got a lot of big things happening. You've got the North Korean threat, which is increasing. They've had 5 nuclear tests. They're probably on the verge of their 6th.
They've done a ton of missile tests. They did like 20 in 2016 alone. So they're really trying to create this impression of inevitability of their nuclear program. So Tillerson's walking right into that mess. Plus, we just deployed our first pieces of THAAD, which is, as you all know,
a poorly named missile defense system.
Missile defense system, but very effective, in my opinion. So the Chinese are irritated about that. And of course,
we deploy that to South Korea. That's right.
Yes, we put that in South Korea. Of course, South Korea is going through a political crisis as we speak. Let's see what else. Oh, we have an assertive China going on in South China Sea and East China Sea. The U.S. is dead in the water on TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So basically, you know, economically in Asia, we're dead. And then you have nervous allies who are looking around saying, okay, is Donald Trump really going to abide by the alliance? Is he really going to back us up? And frankly, you know, Mattis did a really great job when he went out there, first reassurance trip. I thought he hit all the right notes. Tillerson basically undid all of that.
Oh, no.
In one fell swoop.
So how so?
So, you know, I think his first mistake was, you know, he went out without press, and there's been a lot of attention about what that means. But in Asia, if you're not setting the message, the Chinese will set it for you. And so he basically just gave the Chinese a win before he could even get out there. So that was his first mistake. So he used language, Chinese slogans when he was in Beijing, like win-win and mutual respect, which are essentially accommodation terms for the Chinese. And so when the Japanese and the Koreans and others in the region are hearing those terms being parroted by the U.S. Secretary of State, of course, they start to think, well, is the next accommodation us?
I was reading about this and I was tweeting with some folks, you know, about it. Are these, on the one hand, win-win is a totally banal business term, right? It's the sort of thing.
But it means something different to the Chinese.
Does it mean something to Tillerson? Like, do we know why he chose those words, or is that sort of the great guessing game right now?
So, I mean, I think it's problematic either way. So if he did it by accident, it tells me he's not very astute.
And maybe poorly staffed.
And poorly staffed, although that seems bizarre because they've got pretty good people at state staffing him. Hopefully he's listening to them. But if he did it on accident, that's bad. If he did it on purpose, that's even worse. Because the region really hears it as U.S. acceptance of spheres of influence, which is something, of course, that we don't do. Mm. A lot of countries right now are like asking, was it a rookie mistake or was it intentional? And unfortunately, I don't think we really know because there hasn't been any articulation so far by the administration on what their Asia policy is. This summit between President Trump and President Xi in April, although I don't think they've announced the actual dates yet.
Oh, they have.
They have. It's April 6th and 7th.
Because it was going to conflict with the NATO minister.
Oh, yes. Ah, oh, yes. Okay. So they have
which we'll get to later.
Yep. All right. So that's really soon. You know, usually U.S.-China summits are prepared months and months in advance. They cover a range of strategic topics. It's one of the most important bilateral relationships in the world. It covers everything from trade and economics to, you know, security issues, North Korea, South China Sea. I mean, that's a huge agenda. And usually it takes months and months for the two sides to generate the deliverables and the understandings necessary to have the two presidents meet.
I mean, the meeting then becomes sort of, it's the forcing function for all the other bureaucratic work. It's kind of the capstone or the, you know, piece de resistance, but it's not the
beginning of the conversation.
Correct.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, this first summit is really going to set the tone of the relationship for the duration of the administration. And a lot of big questions are out there. So, for example, is Trump going to induce China to cooperate more on North Korea? I don't think we know what his policy is on that yet. There's South China Sea and East China Sea. So will Trump continue the freedom of navigation policy that the Obama administration really pushed? I mean, we haven't seen yet a freedom of navigation operation, also known as a FONOP, occur
Another
yet.
Terrible name.
It is the worst name. It is. So we haven't seen that. Are they going to accept friction on the South China Sea, or are they just going to let it go by? I don't have a sense that the Trump administration cares much yet about the South China Sea.
There's actually, of all places, a really well-reported story in Breitbart I think it was yesterday, on that several FONOP requests have come in from PACOM. They've gone through the building. They have not yet made it through the interagency process. They haven't even started into the interagency process.
As someone who lived through this, it's not a surprise.
No. It is A, not a surprise that this leak is coming out of PACOM, and B, not a surprise that it's has not gone through the interagency process.
Sorry. There are other couple issues that are out there before the summit. Will the administration go ahead on a Taiwan arms sale? It's tradition, as we like to say. So will he do it before or after the summit, which is a big question. And then there are other things, you know, the elephant in the room is trade. You know, will he take a confrontational approach? Will that soil the relationship? And if it soils the relationship, can he get anything else done on the security side?
I think that's the number one question. I think it permeates not just Asia, but right. Europe and a variety of... Right. You know, our trade policies haven't really changed for a couple generations, and we are throwing a ton of things into disorder potentially by shifting the gears, shifting the sands on that section. And so what the relationship is between the economic agenda, the economic nationalist agenda of the administration, and then the security agenda, which is also pretty nationalist, we haven't even done the sort of underlying thinking about the linkages between all of those pieces.
Right.
And that's going to be a challenge.
Yeah. And so if you're HR McMaster right now, you are hopefully he's doing this, thinking through how to structure this first meeting between the two leaders in a way that's going to generate a productive relationship. I mean, you can have a productive relationship and still have points of friction. So hopefully HR is going across the scale of the relationship and deciding with the president, you know, where are we going to lean in with the Chinese and where are we not?
So moving on from the Chinese to a topic we've come back to several times on Bombshell, North Korea. In the last couple of months, we have seen missile tests. We've seen discussion of nuclear tests, the assassination of Kim Jong-un's brother, with the political turmoil in South Korea. There was a leak a couple of weeks ago about the Navy SEALs planning or practicing for a decapitation strike of Kim Jong-un, and any number of other crazy rumors. Everyone we talk to says this is the scariest thing that's going on right now that's not getting a great deal of attention. What is the best case and worst case scenarios you see on the Korean Peninsula over the next 6 months right now? And I think the best case is probably still
that's
absolutely
not a hard
terrifying.
Question.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, listen, North Korea is a problem that's not going away. I do think it is the most immediate threat to the United States. It's a good thing that the Trump administration is doing this broad strategy review, which allegedly they're undertaking as we speak. The bad news is that there's really no good options with North Korea. We've gone the diplomatic route. We did multiple attempts since 1994 at trying to find an accommodation and an agreement on denuclearization with North Koreans, and failed every time. Sanctions we have increased, you know, significantly, especially in the last couple of years, which aren't producing the effect that we want. I mean, North Korea is not Iran. It's not as connected to the global financial system. It's a lot harder to target. So sanctions, you know, really, I think at this point, while important to keep the pressure on, are really not going to get you the answer to the problem.
I mean, that seems true just in terms of, you know, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again.
Right.
And expecting a new outcome. Right. Jeff Lewis had a pretty provocative piece mm-hmm. in the Post a few days ago that made this comparison with Iran in pretty stark terms and said one of the biggest differences with Iran, he said administration folks will point to sanctions, but the piece that no one likes to talk about is concessions.
Right.
We didn't insist on denuclearization as right. a feature of the Iran deal. And so what, if you were really going to think it through, what would be, I'm not asking us to answer this today, mm-hmm. but the thought experiment is really important of what would concessions look like for North Korea? Could you get a freeze? Can you negotiate with them at all? Are they a normal state in any meaningful way such that you could trust them to abide by any agreement? And if so, what should that agreement start looking like? Because the horse is out of the barn. Right.
Do you treat Kim Jong-un as in the rational man theory, or do you treat him as a completely irrational person that you frankly want to get rid of?
So I think the most that we could probably get out of the North Koreans early is a freeze. But that might come at a higher cost for us mm-hmm. in terms of the things that the North Koreans are asking for, like suspension of U.S. military exercises, which for us has been historically a red line mm-hmm. because, you know, when it comes to, you know, the defense of our ally, readiness is really important. And so those exercises actually make a difference. So that's something we haven't pursued before, but it'll be interesting to see whether the Trump administration goes there.
Thank you, Kelly.
This has been fantastic. Thank you for the champagne, too.
We are so excited to be here.
Next up is our favorite segment, White House Mayhem. And after a slightly slower week, a couple weeks ago, we are back, I think, full throttle into the vortex of mayhem. Lauren, what do we have to cover this week?
Thank God we are not a healthcare podcast, because honestly, I don't think we could get into what exactly happened this week. But I will make a quick recommendation for our friend Alon Goldenberg. Had an amazing tweet storm this week, basically saying, because the healthcare deal completely failed, the Iran deal is here to stay.
What? How does that work?
So basically, and Alon, I apologize if I ruin this altogether. So President Trump, with the healthcare deal, he had way too many stakeholders that he had to negotiate with. One problem. Second problem, healthcare is incredibly complex. No shit. I apologize, Mom. Third problem, because it is so complex, there's not like an obvious alternative here. There's things that can be fixed around the margins, but there's not like
Arrow's theorem problem.
There's not basically a new Trump care that's going to be an amazing alternative that's going to fix everything.
Especially not that everyone can have every insurance all the time for free.
For free. Exactly. There's no miracle that we're going to solve this. Iran deal has the same problem, and that it has problems. There's not really a better alternative that people can come up with of like, here's what a better Iran deal would do.
Well, except there's not for like, one alternative that everyone can
that
agree
everyone agrees
is better.
On. Exactly. Exactly. Particularly in the Republican caucus or even in the Democrats, there's not going to be any consensus on here is the new deal that we're all totally happy with and that we should go negotiate on and then go to the Europeans and then go to the Chinese and the Russians and the Iranians. Here's what it is. We have seen from this that Trump, the negotiator in chief, is not actually a negotiator in chief. And he has demonstrated this in absolutely amazing ways in the last week that we will start with and what I will call the handshake that was heard or not heard around the world. He met with Angela Merkel in the last week. And I would love to reenact this in front of all of you, but we're on a podcast. So instead, I'll just stare at Aaron awkwardly for a moment and not shake her hand. Comments.
Awkward.
So awkward. So awkward.
It's cringy. I mean, the clips, the GIFs, the everything, you know, replaying this in near real time on Twitter was kind of crazy. And so on the one hand, it was really weird. I mean, Angela Merkel literally leans over and says, you know, should we shake hands? And he doesn't even look at her. On the one hand, who cares? Maybe the blob is losing its mind. I don't know.
On the other hand, like, this was not the only bad thing that happened with the Angela Merkel visit. This was just the thing that was most obvious and most GIF-worthy, and I will use this GIF till the end of time.
It's a hard G on the GIF, by the way.
Yeah,
these
absolutely.
GIF people are totally wrong.
Absolutely not. But, I mean, apparently, as we learned this weekend, he handed Angela Merkel a bill for what he considered unpaid dues for NATO, which, by the way,
because it's a country club.
Right. A, there are no dues for NATO. We can explain that later on. B, he handed her a bill for one of our closest allies who has been a massive contributor to in Afghanistan in the counter ISIS fight and God knows what else of the last several years for, in his words, protecting Germany for the last several decades. So, I mean, I have been the like adorable special assistant that was like handed, oh, here, come up with this crazy math task so we can hand the Chancellor of Germany this crazy bill and then in this meeting and like done the math and been like, look, isn't this adorable? But I didn't actually understand the implications of this is a freaking bad idea. Radha, why is this a bad idea?
So there is the part of this that is the sort of process and protocol part in which
process is our favorite word.
It really
it's our
is
Valentine. It
in which we, you know, one might have hoped that a conversation between the United States president, new president, and the leader of Germany would include, almost like the case of the Asia visit, a whole host of issues to kind of start this off on the right foot. And while in these relationships, there will be friction, and so we could bring up this issue, so not be the centerpiece and the kind of big takeaway from the meeting. And so that sort of process, the overall, what are the key points? What are the goals of this visit? What's going to be the follow-up on this? It's hard to know. And the second part is, what is the follow-up on this? We don't have assistant secretaries in state or on the defense side. We don't have the engagement with NATO's. We've sent a huge amount of mixed signals with NATO, sending Pence there, Mattis, and their language versus the President Trump interactions with Merkel, which means that at this point, The president has one message. His cabinet secretaries and vice presidents have another message. And there are no presidentially politically appointed assistant secretaries to do any of the staff work that would implement any of this. So what is the value of providing a bill other than the stage presence in doing it? So that's
right.
That's,
it's like a reality show. And the other thing that really bothers me about this, and I'm curious what you guys think, is that this whole notion of using the percent of GDP as a measure of what how good of an ally you are. Like, I recognize this is the measure that we've used for a long time. It's the measure that the president really, really pushed for at the Wales NATO summit a few years ago.
That'd be President Obama.
President Obama, sorry. But, I mean, if you go and look at our NATO allies in terms of who's actually contributing 2% versus who is not, Greece is contributing over 2%. Don't really consider them to be, like, a bestie in terms of allies.
So what gets me about this GDP percentage, which I don't think is wrong, is I think that the problem with Trump's approach on this is that it is so destructive to relationships that we worry about the sort of wider scale impact. But the reason it resonates with his base and the reason we're talking about this is because he's not 100% wrong, right? It is the case that we end up in situations where our allies could be contributing more, especially for their activities. And they sometimes want to have it both ways where they, you know, start military operations and expect U.S. support or U.S. activities. And we saw this happening in both Libya and Mali, right? And so it's not wrong to say we need to have an honest conversation about what those contributions look like and what everyone sort of pulling their own weight looks like in the context of a bunch of other things. And some of those things might be prioritizing U.S. economic needs over European national security interests. But that's a very different conversation than handing a bill to a head of state at a head of state meeting, and right? So those are not the same.
And that gets to my frustration here, which is more that, you know, that handing that bill, it's an invoice. I mean, he's handing an invoice to the German government for services rendered, and which puts us in a deeply transactional relationship. And that's how Trump sees all of these engagements, right? You pay for this, I provide that. And at some level, and I get that this is not politically palatable, but for people who believe in NATO, it is the core of the ethos. It doesn't matter if they didn't pay a damn thing. You protect them, because that's how NATO works. That's how we've structured the entire post-war era in Europe.
It is, but remember, that is not the view of the people that voted for Trump.
For sure.
That's, I mean, not that base view. And that's
to the extent that I think that they have any views on NATO.
No, I think their views are, why are we sending our money to protect these European people instead of spending that money on jobs and stuff in America? Like, we don't have jobs. We need investment in infrastructure. Why is that money going to Germany and not here? And that's not crazy, right?
Well, it's also the money doesn't go to Germany. We don't pay the Germans anything, right? And their money doesn't come to us, right? They're going to spend their money on their army, right? Which is where it's transactional, and it's a bullshit understanding of the transaction.
Yes and no. I mean, yes, the money doesn't go to Germany, the state. Yes, the money goes to bettering the German security. We think that betters our national security, too. Right. I hold that view myself. But what I'm saying is that case obviously did not resonate with the American public. And it is not crazy for
that
there
that
to
case,
be a national security
that
strategy
case hasn't
shift
been made well for a long time. We've taken
perhaps
it too much for granted.
We have made the assumption that everybody thinks that NATO is cool and therefore we don't need to justify it. And then when you start talking about, like, forward operating bases and why we have people based in Germany and other overseas bases, like, people are like, I'm sorry, what? Why are they in Germany and not in Texas or Oregon or anywhere else?
This is then gets to the challenge on the NSC, who does have real professionals, who do have strong beliefs in NATO and the security commitments and the Article 5 and the idea of collective security in general. How are they going to square that with a principal, right, with a commander-in-chief who does not seem to hold any of those same shared
ideas? And I think that's some of what we heard from Kelly, right? How much of this is what the bureaucracy and this sort of institution wants. And I don't say that. I mean, I love the bureaucracy. I heart you guys.
You are the bureaucracy. You are the deep state, Radha.
That's what they call me at home. But how do you square that with this economic nationalism that is the base of this administration that won this? And we really do need to reconcile those things and kind of rack and stack priorities here. And that has to be part of the national security strategy process.
There have been a number of attacks on civil servants to include In Politico this week, there's a lot of personal attacks that were raised, but that were done by Breitbart and in other conservative media against individuals who serve in the State Department and elsewhere, particularly those who work on Middle East issues. We've seen over the last couple of months or so this increasing politicization of the military and the intelligence community, possible allegations of political screening in terms of hiring of civil servants into career jobs. Like, none of this strikes me as the best possible thing for public servants. And since we've all sort of been either in that arena, kind of related to that arena, it's something that I'm really concerned about. Radha, you know, you've been in DOD for a number of years, as well as DOE and the NSC. Like, what is the implication for civil servants who are in current jobs right now?
So I think it's quite terrifying. And I want to put a slightly more human spin on this, which is they're sort of the custodians of some of these key aspects that allow continuity in government to continue. That is terrible. But they're also actual human beings. And releasing their names to the internet trolls to be harassed and threatened is, like, truly astounding. And I think that's the part that really sort of more deeply concerns me, which is, who is going to choose to do public service when it's not just that you might not get hired in, but that your family is going to be harassed and you're going to get threatening emails to your... I mean, for what? To be disregarded and ignored. It seems like there's a deeply pernicious and dangerous effect, not to mention, frankly, just mean, really, really mean effect.
Yeah.
To people who are just trying to do their jobs and jobs that are frankly really important for the America. I will say, you know, it's not just that in addition to all of the other costs, it's kind of a missed opportunity for this administration. Like, these... The thing that I find truly amazing about civil servants in the federal government is they really want to support the administration they're working for.
Right. And they want to make them look good. That is really what, like, makes them look good.
Right. And so, like, their core value is like, okay, boss, you tell me what we're doing and let's do it. Right. And so if this administration really wants to shift gears and figure out a way to do it in effective means to implement policies and strategies, they should be having roundtables with every civil servant on any topic relating to anything they want to do, because those are the people who know how to design and execute the policies that this administration wants.
Especially if they want to change policy.
Exactly.
Right? So they need to both be, I think, a little bit warmer and fuzzier and engaging with the civil service. They also need political appointees. I mean, there's only so much they can actually do without their own, which I find...
Without the 4,000 political appointees they haven't actually put in place.
I find, you know, astonishing. We should note that we do have a new slate of defense appointees that have come across in the last few weeks. They do not include the key posts of undersecretaries of defense for policy or intelligence or acquisition and technology. But they do include the comptroller,
who handles the budget.
Exactly, who handles the budget, Homeland Defense and Global Security, and of course a new DepSec in Patrick Shanahan coming over from Boeing. So we're making some progress on the defense appointees, but still have some major loggerheads, particularly for folks who are paying attention to the policy and technology portfolios.
Yeah, and at DOD alone, we have over 300 to go. I will make a last special plea on behalf of civil servants.
We also have a DepSec for State Department.
Oh, well, that's still, they haven't actually officially announced yet.
That's
it seems
correct.
Likely, though. John Sullivan, who was previously a DOD possible appointee.
For general counsel, but it's now going to likely go to the State Department.
So I will make a last special plea on behalf of public servants that, you know, these are individuals who are not allowed to advocate for themselves, both in terms of their successes, but also as individuals. So, you know, the listeners to this podcast know a lot of public servants, know the good that they
probably
do.
Are public servants, many of
or
them.
Or are public servants. And, you know, that, you know, we're not all perfect. There's a lot of people who screw up. We have seen a number of scandals, but at the end of the day, you know, they are working ultimately for, you know, America, and we swear an oath to the Constitution, not the president. So stick up for a public servant, do it on behalf of Bombshell. We'll buy you a drink someday. But speaking of advocating on behalf of things, we'll talk very briefly of Mattis and Dunford going to the Hill to advocate on behalf of a FY17 and FY18 budget for DOD, most of which people tend to think is dead on arrival. We've talked a little bit about this at Bombshell before. The FY17 budget, they're asking for an additional $30 billion for both base and contingency funding for the ISIS fight. This breaks a lot of China in terms of not actually being within the Budget Control Act limits. So in order to actually pass this, we would have to find other cuts elsewhere, either in the defense budget, which is crazy, or in the non-defense budget elsewhere, or they would be subject to sequestration, immediate automatic cuts for themselves. So there's no political strategy for how to enact this. This is probably just a political play by the administration. But I'm curious if, you know, Mattis actually testified this week talking about this. What was your impression of, like, why is the administration seeking this increase right now? And what's your sense of that, how the FY18 budget process is going to play out?
So let's start with talking about what's in this budget supplement, as it's called. So the idea here is that the budget supplement is aiming at restoring sort of a couple of key portions and sort of kickstarting the spending to having the bestest military ever. So it's to restore readiness to personnel systems, but also to weapon systems. They want to increase the number of service members, so active duty, but also some of the Guard and Reserve caps. And then they want to increase funding for the campaign against ISIS and then buy a bunch of new weapon systems, right? So it's roughly this package that they brought up here. What's not in this supplemental budget is all of the stuff that goes along with buying a bunch of new things and getting a bunch of new service members.
You mean like a strategy?
I don't even,
that's
I'm not
crazy
even
crazy talk.
I'm not even down the road to strategy yet. I just mean literally the other stuff you need. Like, you're going to hire a bunch of people. Those need a bunch of active duty service members, right? So you're going to, what happens there? How do we do recruitment and retention? Which parts of those are we going to invest in? What about the civilians you need to enable those forces? We have a hiring freeze. How does this fit into that? What about, right? So what about the support services for those families? Are we going to be increasing access to the military community and family policy budget as well as the service member budget?
You ask a lot of questions,
Rana. I have so many questions about this budget that
Rana is a walking question mark right now.
I think the big picture here is we want to spend more. I think what's clear from this budget, the signal is we want to spend more on defense. We don't really care about these other things. Stop spending so much money on them. We want to spend it all on defense, and let's do that now. And I think that was the signal value of this, that's the priority. It's not clear to me how credible that signal value is when it doesn't have a package that goes along with it that makes sense in how to do the things they want, even just the things they want, like increase force size and buy the weapon system.
But I think Lauren's point on, you know, how difficult it's going to be to get this, even the supplemental down the road. I mean, we have a debt ceiling vote that has to come up. There mm-hmm. are continuing resolutions that have to get voted on. This question of the Budget Control Act and sequestration, I don't think you can actually offset outside the defense budget. The cuts have to come from within the defense budget.
Unless they repeal the
Unless
BCA.
They repeal the BCA.
Budget Control
we'll
Act.
We'll do a full deep dive on, you know, the defense budget at some future, you know, episode of Bombshell. But, you know, this is, you know, even before, you know, the internals don't make sense.
Right.
The externals don't make
right.
sense. Like, what are we even doing here? I feel bad for the people who lost their nights and weekends putting these documents together because.
And, you know, we've seen on
real
the Congress side from the healthcare that the Freedom Caucus is not happy.
They are not inclined to be
spend a bunch
make
of money.
Happy,
right.
These are the conservatives
right
within the House.
Correct.
Right.
The conservatives within the House that really are on the, you know, they want to cut the spending levels of the government and the government size. And it's not totally clear to me that they would be enthusiastic about repealing the Budget Control Act. So I think,
sure.
I think there's a big sort of uber question mark that can overlay my sub yeah. question marks.
My final prediction on this is that we'll get a CR for the rest of FY17 that we're still in right now. We'll have a continuing resolution, which mm-hmm. means that we stay at basically the same budget level. I think that we'll have a continuing resolution for fiscal year 18, basically at the same level that the Trump budget request and Senator McCain and others' responses are basically political moves that won't go anywhere, but we'll get them both credit. And nobody will pay attention to the fact that we're under CR, which is incredibly damaging because nobody ever does. And that was really depressing. All right, last, let's spend 1 minute on the crazy Trump, Russia, Flynn, Turkey, all the news. The headlines this week, I honestly don't know how anyone got any work done. If you did, God bless you. So between the Chairman Nunes press conference and all of his back and forth trips to the White House, the possibility of Flynn turning in evidence on the Trump campaign to the FBI.
Which is fascinating and super poorly sourced.
Right, absolutely. And I will continue to follow Julia Kayyem's Twitter based on that. The allegation that former National Security Advisor Flynn was basically advocating for some sort of covert operation. You kidnapped Gulen to send it back to Turkey. The FBI, Director Comey, confirming that there's an investigation into at least some member of the White House right now, as well as a number of other things. I could list like 20 more things right now, but frankly, my blood pressure is going up. Aaron, what the hell's going on?
We need an independent investigation.
Well,
I mean,
obviously.
I just think that that's the only thing
I'm getting
comes
that tattooed.
That. You know, God bless Adam Schiff, who not only is a representative from California, but shares a name with a famed Law and Order prosecutor, which I think generates all kinds of good feelings in general.
Really, that is why I feel good.
I think it's right. Yeah.
I like that.
He's done Quiet Mad all week and done a very good job of it. God bless him. But there's a lot that we don't know, and there's no way that the House is any longer in a position to lead an investigation. I think Nunez is completely compromised. It's possible that he was in one of these meetings with Flynn last week, maybe not the exact one where they talked about essentially renditioning Gulen, which led to then Jim Woolsey, the former CI director, thinking that that was too crazy. And when you're too crazy for Jim Woolsey, like, you're really in a special level of crazy. You know, so
but, I mean, look. It's not even that...
It's mayhem.
It is mayhem, indeed. But
it's
not even
It's
that,
such mayhem, it would be a bad spy novel. That's how crazy it is.
It would be unbelievable.
This would be rejected from, like, any television show. Like, Black Mirror would be like, what are you talking about?
Homeland would be like, I don't know. We can blow
seems
up a guy's heart with a BlackBerry, but this seems a little
off. They definitely
off.
Aren't including this in The American. but I think just one more plug for that special investigation, which is this. If you're a Republican and you're seeing this happen, and you think there were down ballot effects, which was what was suggested early on when the initial Russia leak happened and there was initial discussions from then DNI Clapper. You got to be worried about what this means for Congress, for the president, and for elections in general. And I think, look, at the end of the day, the executive branch isn't going to get it done. And the current elected officials can't be responsible for trying to investigate a potential interference that might have affected their elections, and who knows in which directions, right? You might be a Republican and not be the Russians guy. So I think at the end of the day, we've now got multi-branches, multiple different senior government officials, both on the Republican and on the, you know, more neutral side, talking about this. And I think it's probably behooves all parties and all people to try to figure out what actually happened here and kind of back us up a little into the realm of fact versus spy novel pontification, which is, I think, where all our minds are going now.
Okay, so I think we need an independent investigation, and I think if it's run by somebody who is possibly an actor on Law & Order, that would be all for the better.
Amazing.
Yep.
With that music.
Dun, dun.
Boom, boom. That brings us to our pop culture segment, I think quite obviously, which we've had a number of names or suggestions for names for, and I appreciate those folks who have nominated some... titles for this segment. We have discussed, we've heard Bomb Pop, which I have to say is my current favorite. How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bombshell.
That is my personal favorite.
Pretty good.
Okay, but my favorite is Foreign Policy Without Pity, because Television Without Pity as a teenager, oh my God, you guys, I totally love that.
It was pretty. It was so we still are undecided. We're going to talk amongst ourselves and make a decision about what we want to call this particular segment. But I have one question for this segment, which is, what is your most memorable Top Gun reference ever?
Okay. So I was definitely in a meeting with Secretary Gates, Christine Fox, Sandy Winnefeld, and the PACOM commander, whose name is escaping me, all of whom are either in Top Gun or were inspired characters in Top Gun. And they were talking about the defense budget, obviously. And they kept constantly making Top Gun quotes over and over and over again, and looking at Christine Fox and sort of being like, ha, ha, ha.
Who's the inspiration for Charlie Blackwell, better known
right.
as Charlie.
And Christine Fox, basically just stared at all of them with this amazing gaze of, I am more brilliant and sexy and amazing than all of you. And she was, because Christine Fox is basically the most amazing person on the face of the earth.
So this is why I'm never going to get ahead in life. I have no Top Gun references.
Have you seen Top Gun?
I have seen Top Gun.
It's about the airplanes.
I know. I've seen it. It's just whenever I'm in these situations, and, you know, when I worked at DOD, I worked in the Special Operations Office, and there was this constant ongoing movie references. And in fact, when my boss, the assistant secretary, retired, his entire speech that the senior military advisor gave was quotes and references to movies. And I still have nothing for you. So I think that should tell you that deep on my inside, I'm never going to be cool.
Hey, John, can you make Rada see some movies?
That would be super helpful for the rest of
us. Sorry.
This year.
Well, I pale in comparison to Christine Fox, but my first job in Washington, as we talked about last time, was with the Marine Corps. And I was a professor at the Command and Staff College down in Quantico. And so whenever I told people that what I did was to teach Marines, they said, "Oh, really? Like Charlie in Top Gun." And so those of you who know me from Twitter, or those of you who know me from back in the Abba Mukawama days, I am Charlie. And that is the origin of that particular reference.
I never knew that.
I would kill for her Porsche. But that is, you know, the sort of thing that's hard to come by these days. I don't live in Southern California, so I'm not sure that would work quite as well. But Top Gun lives to fight another day. And there's a sequel they're working on. Thanks, everybody, for joining us for another edition of Bombshell. We look forward to seeing you in a couple of weeks.
Bye, all.